Judiciary, Wednesday, February 26, 1975, 8 a.m. Room 407A. Work session on Senate Bill 149, 223, 161, 64, 143, 115, 142, and 140. Debbie Brown?
M.
Carson?
M.
Cook?
Here.
Galen?
Yes.
Robert?
M.
Smith?
M.
Madam Chairman?
Yes. Keep a recess. One member of the IM. You can't take, this is a work session, and we have to have 4 minutes, members present, take any action. So we'll have to wait until 2 more members present, and we'll be in a short recess and then we'll have it.
Which bill do you think is coming here?
149.
Let's put them, did you wish to address 149?
Well, no more than I already have, Senator Brown. I understood this as a work session. I'd already discussed the background of
this. I just wondered if you had any additional points you wanted to bring up.
Well, I'm not sure that I stressed this the other day, and I understood that there was some comment, at least from Lane County, upon the storage requirements. We've attempted to cut down the storage requirements by dropping the permitted construction date to 5 years. I talked to the state archivist, and this seemed to delight him as a way of reducing the cubic content of some of the courthouses. And I understood then the opposition comments that the 40 years were unnecessary as far as criminal cases. And I would stress that I think they are because of the ever-present possibility of post-conviction relief or later things. I'm not unmindful of cases from Klamath Falls. In the last 4 or 5 years, there's a 1933 conviction, and they had to retry the case, and they couldn't produce the transcript, and obviously then they couldn't do it. But we think that what our suggestions are minimal and make sense.
Does anyone have any questions? The objection seems to be the 40 years, but Mr. DeLuna has done research on it and agrees with the judge. Is there any comment, Mr. DeLuna?
No, Madam Chairman, that was my primary concern, too. There have been 2 law review articles written on exactly this point, and that is the retention of records in criminal cases, and the concern being that a post-conviction relief petition could be filed. So I would advise the committee against reducing it any less than 40 years.
Madam Chairman? Well, I wasn't here on the original hearing, but it just strikes me offhand that this is the kind of subject that, if it hasn't been considered, should be considered by the Interim Judiciary Committee. Because I think one could sit around and speculate about a variety of different kinds of cases if you really don't want the records destroyed yet.
Well, it has been
deliberated
in the Interim by the
District Council. Oh, well, that's not a legislative group. I think that I don't have much confidence in any of these study groups that don't involve mostly legislators, because they don't, well, they're capable, but they're not skilled in the eyes of legislators. I am concerned. I don't know. I think I haven't really thought about it. I'll bet you go through and think we want the records in cases involving property rights, not just water rights, destroyed. You want the records in the case of adoption, either that they could be destroyed. No, it doesn't say that. I don't see that it's taken care of. Yeah, but only until they reach 18. What about when they're 39? The question of who their parents are and so on.
Well, you have. May I address the
same thing?
We're not destroying the judgment role in the case center. What we are destroying after a period of time, only with the permission of the presiding judge in there, destroying the cumbersome things that we think are no longer necessary for dead storage. The exhibits and the court reporters know. The judgment role in an adoption case stays forever. And so you answer the question of who's the mother and father and who is the child by referring to the judgment role. We're trying to get rid of as much surplus that's stored in the courthouses as possible. We've got a warehouse on the east side of on top of Belmont that is just chock full of court reporters' notes that we are required to keep, because if you'll notice, that the two statutes that we are amending, one allows destruction within a period of time, and the other requires the county clerk to keep them ad infinitum. And so we attempted to do two things here, to harmonize these two statutes, 7.120 and 8.340, and then to allow the greatest possible leeway to get rid of what is just junk.
Well, let's see, how about historical records? Would this, let me see, with the change you would make here, well, what are the major changes? You'd reduce it from 10 to 5.
Right.
Would this authorize the destruction of any records that are cannot be destroyed at all under the present law?
Pardon me, I don't.
Would this bill authorize the destruction of any exhibits, et cetera, that could not be destroyed under any circumstances?
Well, if you read 7.120, the answer would be no. If you read 8.340, the answer would be yes.
Well, Judge, what's the answer?
Well, the answer then is yes. Well, court reporters' notes are required under 8.340 to be retained perpetually. 7.120 would allow destruction after 10 years under the present statute.
Of everything but court reporters' notes?
As it is, except as noted otherwise, the county clerk who has in his possession notes, tapes, or audio records or exhibits introduced in the circuit court in cases determined more than 10 years prior to may destroy them upon order of the circuit presiding judges. The district, and that's the present statute, that's 7120.
Member Brown.
I'll make a motion. Can we afford to go out with two paths?
Member Brown moves it. We report. Can go 149 out with staff recommendation. Mr. Duane, are there any amendments needed?
No, Madam Chair.
Could I make inquiries?
Yeah, question.
Has our present law then been in conflict?
Yes. This was brought to our attention by Judge Saunders.
One place says that they were keeping for 10 years, another place says they should be kept permanently.
Right.
Now, what is the argument for the reducing it from 10 to 5? Why hasn't 10 worked all right?
Well, we had a number of witnesses here that testified to this point.
Well, simply because we've got too much dead storage.
What is the process that's gone through before destroying? Just is it strictly a county thing, or
it's done in the judicial district by the presiding judge. The county clerk says we have these things, exhibits or so, that are more than X number of years old. We would like to destroy them in statute. Permits under 7120 destruction of exhibits you see after 10 years, comes to the presiding judge and gets an order allowing destruction of exhibits and cases, so on.
What's been the practice in the counties? Have all of the counties followed the 10-year destruction mandate?
I can't answer that if all the counties are
supposed to. Well, we don't know all the counties. We get notices all the time. But unless we decide otherwise, it's the exhibits people under the state.
And they get notices asking to destroy them, or take them back earlier.
You take them back, or if you don't get
destroyed. Well, the only thing is, I wondered about historical records. Is there any possibility that this is going to encourage the destruction of certain things that might be of historical value?
I doubt that, because the state archivists are rather bird dogs, that sort of thing. I know Mr. Dunaway did this around then. We reviewed a lot of our things before destruction, and I found that there has been liaison with the state archivist and the county clerk to prevent that sort of thing.
Well, the presiding judge makes the final order anyway.
That's correct.
Clerk Paul Grohl on the motion.
Aye. Aye.
Robert?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Minister?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
2.3. John tells me that if we adopt this bill, there's also a fee schedule. Is that not packet, John?
Yes, Madam Chairman, there should be a copy of the statute in your packet. And this statute applies only to small claims courts and district courts. There's no comparable statutes relating to justice courts. But in particular, section is 46435. And as you can see, it is based upon the upper limit of $500. The proposal of the bill would raise the upper limit to $1,000. And my recommendation would be, I suppose, that if you're going to accept the proposal in the bill, to then simply extend that fee schedule up to $1,000, making the same changes.
Well, there is some kind of fee in justice court, is it?
There is a fee, yes, but there's no statute like this that.
It's one flat fee.
Yes.
Madam Chairman.
Commissioner.
What testimony did we have in support of this? Well, it'd be my feeling that we've only had small claims at $500 for less than 2 years now. I don't think we have enough experience with that to really be able to appraise it. At least I don't personally have enough experience with it to really appraise whether it's working well with that limit.
Well, you never do have any experience with justice courts.
Oh, yes, I do have cases. And I think I certainly, as a legislator, ought to, might possibly, I know not necessarily, start hearing from people as to the abuses or disadvantages and so on.
Well, you know, you can move from district court, I mean, from justice court.
Well, I know, but this is more summary, and it's, I'm not sure that people would pay as much attention to this sort of thing as if they got served with a regular complaint and summons. And I know you have a right to elect to side in district court, but I just don't think, we moved from, what was it, 200 up to 500 last night. The only person who suggested a change, from what you say, is Senator Burbidge. Not to downgrade Senator Burbidge, but he doesn't know any more about this than I do, apparently. I don't know anything about anything that's happened in between. It's just an idea. I don't think we ought to pass major changes, and this is a major change, unless there's some reason, some experience, some argument why it ought to happen.
John, what was the ballot measure during a small claim?
That was the one that said that you didn't have to have a jury trial up to 20. It used to be you had to have a jury trial over 20, it was raised to 200, and then that put this into effect. I believe, as a matter of fact, then we've only had this law for about a year.
Wait a minute, let me say this now.
When was?
The constitutional provision that was changed.
That was in the last election.
Yes.
1974.
Which was said specifically that there would be no jury trial.
Under 200.
Under 200. In other words, you can't opt for a jury trial. There is no jury trial.
We could legislate and say you had to have one, but we don't have to provide a jury trial.
Okay, under 200. So this bill really wouldn't affect that.
That's correct. You're not talking about the lower limit. The change that was made at the last general session was upping the lower limit from 20 to 200.
From 20 to 200, then
yes.
200 to 500.
This really would not affect the decision in the ballot measure. We're talking about that in-between range, 200 to 1,000. Here, the actual law is 200 to 500.
When did we go to 500, John? Was that last session or was that?
No, that was before 1973. I don't know when, but it was before then.
My point really is, though, what evidence do we have? What real substantial reasoning do we have that it ought to be at 1,000 instead of 500?
Well, Oak Ridge is a fire justice court, and it's quite convenient. We have a use the justice court instead of having to sit around.
Well, you can bring a complaint, an ordinary complaint in justice court. That's not the, we haven't filed an ordinary complaint in the usual lawyer-like way, and justice court just like any other. They have jurisdiction. This isn't a jurisdictional question for JPs. It's a small claim. Well, maybe, but he can file an action in justice court in Oak Ridge, an ordinary action. That's my point. He doesn't have to file a small claim. I just personally don't think that there's, I'm not convinced, I don't know, I'm not convinced that, that this is the time to change this, unless there's some reason.
My concern is that the case needed experience I have observed, and of course, the student thing is not involved in small claims, but I've sat in on some, I've been in court on other purposes, and I've also had people call me up to ask me for advice if they've been served with small claims. And the majority of times, it's the bill collector, that's an agency, collection agency, that is using the small claims procedure because it's very cheap. Mm-hmm. They can crank those things out, and then, of course, if they can't have complaints, down a dozen. And I have some reservations, I think, about raising it in order to make it more convenient for those people who have available to them legal counsel and legal advice and all the wherewithal to go into a court where the defendant automatically has the right to file that bill. Many of those people don't know. They can be moved, and then they can ask for a trial by jury. But many people do not, and they are given notice. On the thing that comes out now in small claims, there's three alternatives there. And the instructions are very clearly laid out, that they can pay the claim, or they can go into small claims and let the judge decide it, or they can remove it to district court and have it heard. And so those alternatives are stated in the papers that are served on persons to go in small claims. Okay, many people can read and many people can understand, but very frequently they have to talk to a lawyer to decide what they're going to do in those situations and whether or not they've got a good case or they don't have a good case. Shall I pay the claim or do I stand a chance with the judge and shall I go to the jury and get a lawyer and all sorts of things. And the more we raise this, it seems to me, the more people are going to be involved in that kind of dilemma. And they're going to be going to attorneys to get advice, even though the attorney can't go in small claims with them.
What about legal aid? Have we had any word from legal aid? Is anybody here from legal aid?
We had a witness on legal aid on
what did
Richard
he
Forrester. Well, he,
what did he say?
He indicated that he felt that where the plaintiff was a licensed collection agency or a corporation or the plaintiff was someone authorized to practice law, that appearing on his own behalf, attorney, that it really was not an unequal contest.
Well, that's what I maintain.
Well, what I'm saying is the repeal of Chapter 6
doesn't
have any of that.
Well, sure you. I don't think this speaks to the question of legal representation and non-legal representation. But he didn't really testify on the question of whether whether this was a good bill from the standpoint of the indigent or defendant who doesn't want to hire a lawyer, or not a good bill. And that's something I think we don't have. And, you know, maybe we could, maybe we could have someone from legal aid and speak to that point. I mean, in their experience in dealing with this, and they probably have more experience in dealing with this than anyone else, I would think, would this be a good for the consuming public or the sued public, or would it not be good for that?
Mr. Forrester, appeared to testify a bill that essentially was raising the limit by two from 500 to 1,000. Did you raise any objections to that aspect of it? The unequal contest aspect that's in front of him.
Now, I have a bill which maybe has been referred here. Maybe we could include in it. Do you know if we have the bill that I put in that provided in certain cases that the defendant in a small claims case is entitled to representation?
No. I don't know. I haven't seen it.
I'm quite sure it existed.
I think that this bill would be important in cases where there are no district courts, and if you have a crowded docket situation and the election to go to circuit court, and you've got a problem, I think this bill would be most helpful.
But they have it now. They can go before justice court and the other.
I understand that, but if you raise it, they must all go above $500 if they bring a claim.
No. Just right in the justice court. No, the justice court has the same jurisdiction, I think, as the district court, or just about the same. So this doesn't give them the right to go to justice court. They already have that right. It just gives them the right to have it treated as a small claim rather than an ordinary suit in justice court.
We have no district court. We have the justice court and circuit court.
So they bring in justice. District court is just a glorified justice court. That's all it is.
Well,
I think so.
$2,500.
I think it's $2,500. John's checking it, right, John?
Justice court is $1,000.
$1,000
for the most part, yeah.
This is a small
grant. Well, how about generally?
No. Justice court generally.
So they can go to $1,000 now. So this in the other way. In other words, I can come in and file a regular complaint and go to $1,000 now. So this isn't needed.
But they have to bring an action.
They have to bring a regular action, usually with a lawyer.
$25.
This would allow them to bring it without a lawyer, up to $1,000.
District court is $2,500.
Over $1,000. I don't know. I mean, I'm really, you know, at a loss in a sense. I'm just not convinced. And if we could have, would it be possible to have with someone from legal aid come in and
the only good anti-lawyer bill we'll ever have in judiciary, probably, for the whole lousy country.
Does
it?
The anti-people bill, you know.
It's pro-people.
Lawyer. Lawyers. They're law leaders.
Anyway.
There are a number of grammatical amendments which, in my opinion, should be made in the bill. The only substantive amendment which I would suggest is to add an additional section which, if it's the committee's pleasure, would make a violation of the provisions of this interstate compact a crime, or indicate what the penalty would be that would attach for a violation. If you look at Article 4 on page 4, it seems to contemplate that there would be some type of criminal penalty, but there is none provided in the bill, and there's none in the existing statute. So my suggestion would be to, if you want to have a criminal penalty, that you add it to this bill as a separate section.
And the comment was made when we were having a hearing on this that we couldn't change any of the language in this thing, or it would not be a valid and binding contract agreement.
You could change, or you could make this amendment, which I suggest, without changing the language of the compact. If you look, I would be adding, say, an additional section, and the compact itself concludes on page 7, where you see the line across the page. So it would simply be an additional amendment to Oregon law, which really would not change the language of the compact. It would simply provide for a penalty, which the compact seems to anticipate in Article 4.
Mr. Chairman, one question only. How much more staff would you need?
We've taken a position on this that it would amount to a workload increase, and it's a situation that we have to restore.
Are you telling me you would observe it, or you'd ask for more staff?
We can't ask for more staff.
Then can we do the job?
I think we can do the job every bit or better than we're doing it currently.
Expeditiously?
Expeditiously. And I mean that particularly in relation to the adoption agency concerns.
What's the general feeling about the bill in general before we get amendments? I'm interested in.
There's been no opposition to it. What's their objection?
Because they feel that the polling services investigation for delaying and causing our paperwork.
Do you think there's any substance to their objection?
My experience with polling services has been a considerable delay in getting that. It really shouldn't affect the whole business to any degree at all. Yeah, of course, because they have such a, unless it's in a secret, yeah, but their operation is one in which they've almost perfected the procedure, and they work with it, all kinds of agencies anyway. And the Boys and Girls Aid Society, I think it's that they just didn't want more paperwork with phone services.
And now the positive side, what's the positive argument on the bill?
Good place for children. Mr. Mayor, just to express to you, I think the first question comes up that you want to come to. We've been trying to gather up these laws that prohibit
changing
those
kind of things.
What's this prohibit?
This would prohibit, if you look at, say, page 4, line 12, sending, bringing, or causing to be sent or brought any receiving state of a child in violation of the terms of this compact. Basically, the terms of the compact that they're referring to are stated in Article 3 on page 3, the conditions of placement, which means that before they send a child to another state, they have to go through an agency in the other state and make sure that there are going to be adequate facilities for the child and that his best interest will be served by sending him to this other state. The sending state retains jurisdiction over the child, and even once the child is in the receiving state, and they're still responsible for his financial well-being. So things of this nature, if the sending state did not do this, they would be in violation of the compact and subject to the penalty.
Would an individual citizen be able to go from Oregon to a hospital in Washington and obtain a child for adoption and bring that child back without becoming involved in this law, or would he become involved in this law? Well, assuming that they adopted this compact, would this, I haven't ever had one of these ones in my practice, where the prospective parents went to a hospital in Washington, picked up the child by prearrangement, brought the child back to Oregon for a private adoption without becoming involved in an adoption agency. Would that be prevented by the adoption of this compact, let's say, if Washington and Oregon adopted this compact bill?
I think that, say, if the adoption were not affected in Oregon, or in Washington, yes, they would be affected by this bill. If the adoption took place in Washington and they were the parents, when they brought the child back here, this bill would have no effect upon them.
But this would prevent them from bringing the child from Washington to Oregon, let's say.
If there were no legal relationship between them, yeah, I think so. However, if they were related to the child. This bill has nothing to do with a situation, say, where you know, the parents take a child to relatives in Oregon, parents take a child to relatives in Washington, and the child remain in Washington for some period of time under the care of those relatives. This bill would not affect that. However, if you're talking about, say, individuals from Oregon who have no legal or blood relationship with a child in Washington, I would say that, yes, they would have to comply with the provisions of this compact before they could bring the child to Oregon. If the adoption took place in Washington, though, there would be no difficulty.
There would be some the situation if the child were already under CSD for some reason, and abuse, child abuse, or they were taken for some reason, parents were not no longer going to have to custody of the child, then this would apply if there was to be a placement with another relative in another state. Those parents couldn't automatically take that child and put them with somebody else.
That's true.
If, in fact, they have already come to the attention of the court.
Yeah, if they're already under state agency jurisdiction.
Do you want to come to attention?
Well, I would think there should be. Now, in the news today, there was this guy, I don't imagine it's involved here, where he was setting up a place out in Puerto Rico or someplace, where he's taking young pregnant girls and he's on trial, going on trial today for allegedly selling $1,000, $10,000 or something. I would think that if this is a proscribed, prohibited practice, there should be some kind of at least a Class C misdemeanor, I would think.
Right.
Okay, I'd like to move to reconsider so I can make a motion to raise it to a Class A machine.
Any objection to reconsideration?
I move that we make it a Class A machine.
Motion for Class A machine. What's my role? Are you down?
Aye.
Robert?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Now, you mentioned a certain number of grammatical errors. If you change it, are you changing the compact language or existing non-compact language?
Some of it is in the compact, but frankly, I think they're misprints. I don't think the compact was written this way.
Okay.
Can you check the compact? No, I haven't, but there are such technical amendments that I'm sure it would not change the language.
These are conditional amendments subject to checking to make sure they're not in the original compact, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes. First Amendment is on page 2, line 6. After therein, I believe there should be inserted therein a separate word in. So it would read states legally joining therein in a form substantially as follows.
All right.
Next one. That's not in the compact.
No, it's not. In line 11 on page 3, I believe the and should be or.
Next one.
Page 4, line 16. Just a grammatical, this could be one way or another, to make it precise, you should delete the of, stands or brings the child and the receiving state. Up in line 15, you have of both the states in which the sending agency is located, and you would follow that and the receiving state. There's no need for the additional of.
With so many mistakes, I have a suspicion that it's in the original compact.
And is in the original.
This is fact.
Correct.
On page 3, line 11.
Yeah. Is this correct, Joe?
That's the official publication.
That's what I meant. 23 states said this couldn't possibly happen. All right. And is in the original if you want to go back to him. Where's your next one?
Page 4, line 32.
No, line 16. Well,
line 16, page 4.
Yeah. Put enough to strike the eye.
Penalty.
Under receiving state.
Oh. Is receiving spelled wrong? Is that
no,
the question?
No.
Huh? Where are you?
Line 16.
Well, I can't see.
The sending agency is located or from which it sends the parental child of the
receiving. Okay. You want to know where to strike that out? You can't strike that out.
All right.
Madam Chairman, let me suggest this. Why don't we? I would move that our counsel prepare the amendment that we would have made if it weren't for the fact that the original draft had the erroneous language, and that we should have that in the record, and that the intent, legislative intent, as far as this committee is concerned, that in interpreting the compact, it should be interpreted as though the correction contained in Senator Winter's proposed changes should. That this is the interpretation that we think should be placed upon the compact, even though the language is not.
We already have them prepared, and all we have to do is announce that is our intent.
So I move that it is the sense of this committee that the in interpreting the compact in Oregon, that this is the intent and purpose.
Let me agree, John. What would be the other?
In line 32 on page 4, there's a use of yet transfer referring to the child. I would insert his there.
They're trying to be neutral.
Another way in which that's
the first trimester.
That could also be amended, simply say, or the transfer of the child. And
well, Madam Chairman, let me ask a question. If it doesn't change substantially the pact, why change it? I mean, it might be grammatically more correct, but if...
We want to demonstrate that we understand that they're good grammar. Someone might say, did you write that?
The suggestion was that we not adopt the amendments, the principles put them in the record and then attached to the court.
Oh, okay, go ahead. That's fine. I don't think it's
good. The other, the last is on page 5, line 20. Prior to this being sent to such other party, that should be prior to the child being sent to such other party.
But no such placement shall be made until a child is given a clergyman and notice to the parent regarding the opportunity to be heard prior to this.
Well, this is his.
Oh, that would be a good answer.
We have one. Right now.
The motion is by the chair, page 5, line 20. To break the T and reach this and make it his. Any objections would be most impressive. Is there a motion on the bill?
I move, first of all, Madam Chairman, that it is the sense of this committee that the amendments proposed by Mr. DeWinter should be included in the record so that should a court interpret this at some point in the future, that the language as contained in the compact should be read to include the amendments that we would have made had it not been for the fact that we can amend it and still not get in trouble on the compact.
And with that, do you object to it?
After we had hearings on the bill, I believe we received this letter from C.D. Remington today. I'm not sure we considered the trust of her.
Is it retirement?
Yes. The date on it is the 18th of February, I believe. This will post our hearing. I haven't read it carefully yet. I know we did it wrong.
Do you know if John Hurd is
the last thing that was set up at 161?
Is there a 161?
The whole package is 161.
I've got extra time.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Well,
I'll
have been advised that we if we pass it at all, we have to pass it in the form that we did in the end.
The notice you're talking about could be added, but I'm not quite sure I'm going to advise the notice that you...
I might say, Madam Chairman, that at least where a child has been determined to be a delinquent, if you look at Article 6 on page 5 of the compact, there is a requirement for a court hearing on notice to the parent or guardian. Before the child can be sent to another state.
Yeah.
this is simply removed. I think the procedure would simply be that they would remove the opportunity for a person to oppose the judgment.
Are you opposing the makeup of the council, or are you opposing the council in general?
I don't know how you could create a council that would be more effective than it seems to me a governor would be in considering all the possibilities of persons to be named. Because this council would sit and go over qualifications and of people who are interested in being appointed a judge, or I would assume that personnel in the governor's office would do the very same thing. It's not the governor alone that makes the appointment, it's all the people that are working in the governor's office that have that responsibility. But it requires that the governor must choose from that group.
There ought to be one from at least every school day.
Yes, Carolyn?
Yeah.
I'm going to vote against this, no matter how it's amended. But if we were forced to have this, I think that there shouldn't be any members of the legislature, and I think that's an unjustifiable mixing of the judiciary and the legislative branch, and I just don't think that's legislative business, choosing judges. And while the president, the two people that are designated by the Speaker in the House may be exceptional politicians, they're not necessarily exceptionally qualified to choose judges, I would suspect. That's first. I think if we are going to have the Missouri system, I'd prefer to have some kind of a council. And I think if we are going to have a Missouri system, that the provision contained in SJR 6 is preferable to the one in SJR 9.
Would you support it? If
the commission will retain that the government is going to have to be recommended. Well, then what's the substitute in the committee's recommendations for what is now the bar's law? Because the judge doesn't have to stay within the recommendations of the bar.
I consider that superior.
You would?
Superior nomination.
Feel referring to the legislators shouldn't be included in the commission, but I'm not sure the Supreme Court judge should be either. Because that person is looking for somebody that would be compatible with his political philosophy and everything else to sit on a courtroom. In other words, you're choosing your own.
Well, what if you were to say that the Justice of the Supreme Court would be on it for collection in all cases except for the Supreme Court, and in that case, perhaps the Chief Justice of the Court of Appeal would participate in that capacity.
That would eliminate his consideration, which I think would be a serious
Well, I didn't say the President of the Judiciary. Who's the head of the Judicial Council?
I thought that was a group that really isn't competent to discuss the disposition of records and that.
Well, I don't know anyway.
Yeah, you're going to vote against it.
I'm going to vote against it, yeah. I'm just trying to be helpful.
I'm going to vote for it right now, Madam Chairman, but I think you're trying to muck it up, so I have to vote against it. I move the floor to be passed into this.
Move the floor to be passed
into Madam Chairman, there is in SCR 9, as it is written, a problem on page 4 and that is that it does not provide for what occurs if there is a majority, is no majority voting no or yes. In other words, if there's a tie.
What line?
If you look at lines 8, 9, part of 10 there, they indicate that if a majority of those voting upon the question vote yes, the judge shall be elected to succeed himself. If a majority vote no, he's out of office, but there's no provision if there's a tie.
What happens in the case now if there's a tie?
That'll be a lot in most cases. Judge McNary, I understand, Senator McNary, I heard somewhere, lost a election to the Supreme Court by one vote.
Senator Smith, do you want to make any motions for that? Motions to vote for the count.
Should be delay the vote on something critical until we have a larger.
As long as the yacht turns out, then you can delay it.
You can always wait after that. When Molly's here, I don't know how
long it is.
Chris Caldwell. Did you get your answer?
Aye.
No.
Robert?
No.
Smith?
Aye.
Molly Turner?
Aye.
Dale?
You don't want it cleaned up, though.
My conscience is clean.
One more, I like to promise. Oh, no.
Bill would allow the taking of fingerprints and photographing of a juvenile where the child is taken into custody for the purposes of conducting an investigation to see whether or not the child has been abused. In your packet under this bill, you should find amendments prepared by the Children's Services Division and an amendment prepared by me. The thrust of the amendments prepared by the Children's Services Division are to delete the possibility of taking the fingerprints of the child in this instance, but allow the taking of a photograph. The alternate amendment which the Children's Services Division has prepared would allow both the taking of a photograph and fingerprints, but put the qualifications that you see there on the taking of fingerprints.
I'm not familiar with the practice in Multnomah, and as far as evidence is concerned, in the child cases, there's no problem. In Multnomah, in getting the photographs and the evidence, and I've had the same experience with them, and there's no problem.
There are those proposed amendments, John. I don't think that those are favorable. You can use them. I don't think you can find them.
6% doesn't equal it.
I like yours better.
What, John, say?
There are some changes which I make that you should be aware of. The first change is that my amendments would apply whether or not the child was taken into custody. An example might be if there's a suspected child abuse, the grandparents may bring a child to a police agency saying, my son-in-law or daughter-in-law has abused this child, I'm taking the child to the hospital. The police agency decides it's not necessary to take the child into protective custody, but you still may wish to take a photograph or a fingerprint. And so with my amendment, those could be taken in any instance where there was a suspected abuse, whether the child is taken into custody or not. The other change would be the Children's Services Division amendment refers to ORS 418-760, which is in the child abuse provisions. However, that really is not the legal authority for taking a child into custody. The authority is 419-585, so I've simply done away with the idea that that I think is presented in the Children's Services Division amendment that 418-760 is a basis of legal basis of taking a child into custody. My amendment also requires reasonable cause to believe that there has been child abuse. There's no language to that effect upon that effect in the Children's Services Division amendment. Currently, the child abuse statute, before, say, a person, say, a doctor, has to report possible child abuse, he has to have reasonable cause to believe that is so. And before the police agency can take the case to the district attorney, they have to have reasonable cause to believe that there has been a child abuse. And so I've incorporated that language here so that you would restrict the taking of photographs unless there's reasonable cause to believe that the child has been abused.
Yeah, I just want to ask a question, then I will. Are so-called non-professional, that is, photographs outside this amendment, admissible in cases of child abuse?
I've situation, say, if the district attorney wants to charge, say, someone with assault for abusing a child, I've had no difficulty ever taking pictures of that. Now, it's not taking pictures of the child for the purposes of identifying the child. It's taking pictures of the injuries of the child to use in some subsequent prosecution. I've had no difficulty doing that under the existing law.
And you admit evidence that a picture was taken with someone who can identify it. Is that admissible? Not in the presence or not by allowance of the district attorney.
If some other relative took the picture, whether or not the state could have done that.
Yes, the doctor.
No, yes, that could be done.
Question before you move to the minute. What about fingerprinting? You've excluded that.
Yes, I have. I haven't made any provision for fingerprinting.
I feel very strongly that your child is. The suspected victim or known victim of child abuse, that the child should be fingerprinted for possible identification as a homicide victim. Any time a child is in a risk situation like this, it is highly advisable that fingerprints be made a matter of record with the national agency. You get a battered child dead in a ditch in a shallow grave, and a tip of dental records for fingerprints on the
other. Your objection to the last sentence of CFD amendment be added to yours.
Up to the committee. There's no.
That seems to me to be a reasonable way to approach it.
This doesn't assist, however, if you're trying to identify the body of a child is found.
Yes, sir.
Not again, it's just a long record.
The body of a 5-year-old is found in a ditch in the desert, he's after death, and he's still capable of lifting fingerprints. You're going to have to. You should have an opportunity to run those through a national file, FBI fingerprint files, to see if the child is identifiable.
I don't really see anything wrong with his reasoning. I really don't, it's not abuse.
I think the difference is a victim versus a live child.
Well, okay.
That's my problem.
The live child may be dead in an abuse situation.
Even
fingerprint
all babies and
fingerprint.
Yeah, that's.
Down.
I don't.
My, mm-hmm. Only 35 years ago, 35 years ago, my scoutmaster fingerprinted all boys in that troop because we were constantly in the risk situation. My children all fingerprinted.
Mm-hmm. Well,
Senator Roberts.
Senator Roberts.
Just sounds like my committee.
Will be his name Himmelschmidt.
Why did you look at him when you said Senator Roberts?
I'm looking at you. The lifestyle situation. You may take some photographs and tell maybe very deep in the so that when the child recovers, the pictures that were taken at the time of the abuse certainly doesn't look like the child. Or 5 years later, if the child was abused when it was an infant, and it was abused 5 years later, you're not going to be able to tell whether that's the same child 5 years later it was abused when the child was young, because of the change in features and growth and everything else. So the testimony was that the only way you can identify a child that may be consistently abused and may be reported and it may come in two and three and four times is through the fingerprint.
I might add
the photograph won't identify.
Madam Chairman, I might add that you can get fingerprints now with consent of the juvenile court. That's the existing statute. So yeah.
Well, you know, Madam Chairman, I think Senator Walt Brown has a good point, and I'm inclined to favor the fingerprinting of those who are involved in alleged molestation or abuse situation. I'd move in substance that we include such a provision.
Okay, the motion is to fingerprint children,
when they're born. Fingerprint them when they're born.
Well, we let officers arrest on probable cause for, we're even proposing a criminal in the new vehicle code, even on a speeding ticket. And I would think that where you've got a child, that there's evidence of possible abuse, like a bruise, you know, that should justify putting it in the record, I think.
Madam Chairman, the question is, what will be done with the fingerprint file? And where will it be kept, how long will it be kept, and who will have access to it? That's my own hang up. I think it ought to be there until the child no longer needs the protection. And I don't know if that's
child. Of course, Senator Walt Brown's point, he thinks it ought to go into the national fingerprint file, so that if the child is, let's say, the kind of person sometimes, child beaters are from all economic classes, I believe, in reading an article. They're not necessarily in the lower spectrum, so they might not necessarily move around. But we're transient people. I think his point is, someone who's abusing a child moves from here to Washington or Idaho or California or New York or wherever, and another child abuse case comes up. He'd like it so we could go into the fingerprint bank that is maintained by the FBI, is it, or is it, and run that print through and see if there's ever been another reported instance or conviction or whatever of child abuse.
Good call, Roland.
Hi. Hi.
Robert Stone?
No.
Ron Phillips? No. Who's in there? Mm-hmm. Motion to the court,
and that I'm talking. No. And there will be one on your call.
Well, let's see, what's the second line? How about then, the next nearest to that is the Children's Service Division that allows them fingerprints may be taken only when necessary to ascertain identification of the victim. And that's stronger than the Winter Amendment, isn't it?
No, it's just an addition to.
An addition to?
I do. Look to the Winter Amendment, and for the fingerprint added, I would add that last sentence.
To your the winner's motion, all right.
The addition to the winner's amendment is where the child taken into custody under the provisions of, you know, and the alleged victim of the child that needs photographs of the child. No, that's not.
I want to second.
Fingerprints may be taken only where necessary to ascertain identification of the victim, and in no instance shall such fingerprints become a permanent part of the files of any public or private agency. Is that it?
That's
the minute discussion of that. Quick call, Roland.
Livingston.
Aye.
Cook.
Aye.
Roberts.
Aye.
Smith.
Aye.
Nansen.
Aye. The bill is amended. Actually, it doesn't matter that the present law doesn't do.
It doesn't do anything the present law doesn't do?
Well, it does, with regard to the fingerprints, it allows the court still, under the existing law. So.
Under the existing law, the court can allow fingerprints?
That's correct.
I mean, it doesn't add a thing to what we've got?
No.
Why does it put it in the first place? Jesus, but it doesn't add anything.
Well, let me ask Tim what why we have here. Why do we have it here? Yes or no?
You explained it testimony that there was a statewide task force that developed with the changes in the child abuse reporting law, and this was a spin-off. There is a consideration in some counties where the court does not have a blanket permission for law enforcement to take pictures. The court order has to be obtained, or the court permission has to be obtained. Sometimes the gap between the time the child is picked up and when pictures could be taken and the time when the court permission could be obtained, certain bruises or confusions could subside.
Well, that's not true, because there's a group of pictures in there, and the court could authorize an afterward.
Well, having Mr. DeWitt and I having some private officers
before in the past.
Reservation for further amendment.
Aye.
We had a bill like this last time.
I think we had about 800 like this.
143.
You should have two things in your packet under 143. The first is a copy of existing statutes and the statute with which I'll be, or the statute about which I'll be talking mostly is 169.075, Standards for Local Correctional Facilities.
This is not the one that came back to us.
No,
that's 144.
There are also some amendments which I prepare based upon testimony before the committee and discussion of the committee during this hearing. The First Amendment would be to allow a inmate to bring suit only where these mandatory standards listed in 169.075 are allegedly violated. The bill, as in its current form, would allow suits to be brought whether in instances where these mandatory standards have been allegedly violated or guidelines that are for the most part simply recommendations of the corrections division have been violated. So the first set of amendments would move basically subsection 2 of the bill into 169.075 and would say that an inmate can sue the local jail facility only where there's an alleged violation of mandatory standards, not where there's an alleged violation of guidelines as to the operation of the facility.
Well, in other words, Madam Chairman,
yes.
In other words, I suppose that if there were 23-hour, 45-minute supervision, and something happened in jail in that 15-minute period, a person may wouldn't be able to bring suit against it.
Theoretically, yeah. Theoretically. Whether or not that would happen in practice, I don't know.
Well, it could be alleged that there was no supervision for any kind of altercation, and it would have to be proved then that there was supervision. That the guy had stepped out to have a cup of coffee or anything else.
How do,
or we went to sleep, or a myriad of other kinds of horror stories that they can't bring to mind.
Madam Chairman, how does 169.075 relate to 421.180, that's in SB 144? What's the relationship or possible relationship between these two bills, should we pass them both?
144?
Yeah. In other words, they're obviously part of the same package. I wonder, we're talking 144, which we have back before us here about that they have a notice that they have to adopt certain rules, that have to meet certain standards. If that's the case, is it, would the remedy and...
Yes.
Local jail, not state institution.
Chapter 169 related to local jail.
Okay, so there's
That's correct, and that would be the difference. There would be no... interrelationship of any significance between the two bills. In 144, the bill that was referred back to the committee, you're talking about disciplinary rules promulgated by the Corrections Division to be applicable to state institutions. Here you're talking about not only facilities, but also if you look, say, at subsection 8, there is reference to disciplinary rules, but you're talking about disciplinary rules in local jail facilities, not state facilities.
Well, Madam Chairman,
yeah.
I think this is a backdoor approach to enforce guidelines for operations of local jails, and I don't think that's the way to do it. If you want to put a penalty provision in the statute for those jails that don't come up with standards, penalize the counties to make them do their jobs as the state sees it must be done. That's one thing. But this is a backdoor approach to the enforcement of jail standards. I don't believe this is a correct approach.
Madam Chairman, I had communication from a sheriff down in the store. He said that this has been put on the ballot to him several times. Failed 6-1 for improved reconstruction of the jail there to bring it up to standards. And he's in a spot, and I tend to agree with Senator Smith that we should approach this more directly. And how that would be achieved, I'm not sure whether they will build a jail and reconstruct the jail and subtract from there.
Liquor receipt. Madam Chairman, the existing law with regard to these mandatory standards is this, that the Corrections Division goes around and inspects local jail facilities, and if they see that the local facility is not complying with these mandatory standards, they go to them and they advise them to change. If they don't change, under the existing law, the inspectors can go to the Attorney General, and the Attorney General, in turn, can bring legal action to force the local facility to meet these standards. The thinking, I think, of the proposers of this bill is that evidently there's going to be a cutoff of funds for Corrections Division to actually inspect local facilities. And with that in mind, they thought that the only way in which these standards could be enforced would be by giving a right to sue to the inmates. That basically was the thinking behind the bill, and what the existing law is now as far as enforcing the standards.
On what do they base that assumption of the cutoff? Is it that the governor hasn't included it in his budget, or?
I think that's, you know, that's okay.
Now, what's the current status of this proposal? Has anyone gone before Ways and Means, or a subcommittee of Ways and Means?
Our budget hearings from the division, I think, start on Thursday. Of course, we're put us in a strange relationship.
You're with the state, correct?
Yes, I'm the on-site support of the state.
So it's a little bit hard for you to come in and testify in opposition to the governor's proposal to understate the question.
We have a lot of support from the League of Cities and so forth that will apparently be there. So
the last credit be in for
that? I think so. Steve Donovan's going to get that one.
Well, Madam Chairman, wouldn't it be appropriate if we consider this at all, it at least be postponed until after the consideration of the corrections budget that relates to this question, since it is, in a sense, a substitute for existing practice, albeit maybe a poor one. I move that we table this measure until after the budget of the Corrections Division on this subject has been considered by a subcommittee of Ways and Means.
Senate Bill 115 is a proposal of the Governor's Commission on Judicial Reform to repeal the existing statutes which requires a $25 fee in domestic relations cases in order to compensate for the appearance of a district attorney, which, as I understand, the attorney never appears.
Madam Chairman, maybe I didn't do this, but I thought I asked someone to prepare.
You did.
Are they ready? Okay.
If you look in your packet, you should have two separate amendments. Madam Chairman, there are two separate amendments. One is one pager and the other two pages. The first one would make up the loss as a result of repealing ORS 21-130 by simply adding on to the general filing fee in circuit court. The second proposal would make up the loss by distributing it between the circuit court and the district court.
Now, presently the money goes into the general fund of the county?
State
general fund. And then we in turn, we're paying for almost all of district court now, aren't we? Most of the district court expense being paid at state level?
We don't do that.
To the salary of the judge.
So this is the loss would be to the state general fund.
Right.
But if it went back to the district court, then we'd actually be transferring money. What would we be doing? We'd be picking up more money from the district court level for the state, even though it wouldn't get back to the county. That's what the effect of this? It seemed to me to be consistent and simple that number one, then, we don't get into this question of district court. It simply says that circuit court litigants are going to pay the burden that's now borne by circuit court litigants who are seeking divorces.
There is an alternative that it could all be put on divorces. Now, it's my understanding that the individual filing fees for divorces can be waived, isn't that right?
Yes,
the effort.
Yeah, and I don't know why people seeking divorces should be discriminated against. It's a legal right that they have. don't know how this would really be treated any different in the general levy than someone asking for an adjustment of title.
It's not a prior referral, but okay.
I don't think it does. Madam Chairman? I move the number one set of amendments, which as I understand it would be to simply shift it internally within the circuit court litigant.
I got a public amendment because we haven't had any testimony to things, and just shifting the cost around so the state still can collect a certain amount of revenue without any indication that this is a fair amount and that it's for probate proceedings. And just because we're trying to get $25 someplace else doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Doesn't it make more sense than leaving the money in there on the
board? I'm
going
to move the bill out as it is.
Oh. How many million does it cost this, how many million is it? $1 million a year or biennial?
There's no prior reference to waiving
that.
Senator Cook's amendment, I had them to the first set of amendments, which change the 6 foot fees, fine fees from $7 to $18.
Call
roll. Senator Jones?
Aye.
Chris?
Aye.
Don't?
No.
Chris?
No.
Madam Chairman, I'll move Senator 154
to
pass the
Senator
Robert Hughes.
Any discussion? Madam Chairman, I move to amend Senator Roberts' motion to that the bill be referred to the floor with a recommendation to the President that it be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
The amendment to the motion is that it goes to the desk with a recommendation of vote Ways and Means. Are you recommending we do that?
No.
No. It goes to the desk with a recommendation of vote Ways and Means. Discussion with that motion. I'll oppose the motion, Madam Chairman, because I think what we're doing here is everything doesn't have to go to Ways and Means. $795,000. They'll know we passed the bill if they then want to initiate their own bills down there to raise the filing fees of other cases. That can be done.
Clerk call roll.
Senator Jones?
Aye.
Robert?
No.
Yes, Madam Chairman. If I want to give notice now that if it does go to the floor due pass, I think I may file a minority report, which will include the amendment.
Okay.
I don't want to
know
it.
Don't have to.
I don't have to. Thank you.
That's it.
I just want to put you on notice that I don't want to join.
People who are going through probate and have as much right as people going through divorce, and if there's no need for the fee, then if there's no need here, then
I think there's a need for the money, and so it becomes a question of just simply of which litigants are
going to pay for it.
Right.
So those who go through probate are going to pay it for those who go through divorce.
That's right. I don't want to discriminate against those people who seek and obtain divorce. Even though I never thought in obtaining one myself.
But we got to have those people, because if we didn't, we wouldn't have legal aid. I mean, it's just around to us, finally.
Okay,
further
discussion. Let's call it off.
Aye.
No.
Robert?
Aye.
No.
Aye. No detail. Senator 140. I'm going to start petitioning the court for all of my divorces to waive the fee and charge my client.
You haven't been doing that? They can't afford to pay the fire fee, but they can't afford to pay the lawyer.
Senate Bill 140 is a bill that was introduced by the Judiciary Committee at the request of the Commission on Uniform State Laws. It basically allows for a right to contribution to tortfeasors. If you recall, Austin Crow came to the hearing and testified and put forward a package of amendments which should be in your packet. Since the hearing, there have been two letters which came in which support the bill. One is from Lawrence Dean of the Association of Trial Lawyers of America, the Oregon chapter. Austin Crow called me and said that Dean had informed him that he supported 140 with Austin Crow's amendment. The bill, or the letter which you have in your packet, simply states that he supports passage of Senate Bill 140. The other is a letter from David Landis, who indicates that the organization which he represents cannot take a position on the bill. However, he personally, as an attorney, a defense attorney, would support Senate Bill 140 with Mr. Crow's amendment.
Madam Chairman, I move we send Senate Bill 140, well, first we amend it in accordance with the Crow Amendment. I move to amend it to incorporate the Crow Amendment.
The Crow Amendment. John, do you want to go through that one?
Yes. If you look at the package of amendments that we have, I think that's the easiest way to go through them. He does restate the language in Senate Bill 140, except for his amendment. The first group of amendments which he makes, which include the following. One, he substitutes the words proportional for pro rata. Two, he deletes the provision in Senate Bill 140 which indicates that an intentional tortfeasor does not have a right to contribution. In other words, if you look at page one of Mr. Crow's amendment and you look down to subsection 3 of section 1, Senate Bill 140 as drafted says that an intentional tortfeasor doesn't have the right to contribution. Mr. Crow's amendments would delete that. What he's doing in his amendments is allowing contribution based upon a person's relative degree of fault. And if you base contribution upon that concept, most likely the intentional tortfeasor is going to take up the greatest part of the damages anyway. And so
Wanton is another problem too.
Mr. Crow's amendment would simply treat all tortfeasors the same for the purposes of contribution, except that they would have to contribute based upon their relative degree of fault. I might also add that the Uniform Commission's comments, official comments, indicate that one of the reasons they put the subsection 3 in their bill was because they did not allow for the distribution of contribution based upon relative degree of fault. So, it would be consistent with Mr. Crow's amendment that he deletes this.
Did Mr. Crow say anything?
They are Mr. Crow's amendment.
I know it, but did he prepare them as
he submitted them. They were not prepared at my request. He came and submitted these amendments of his own at the hearing.
I think they're reasonable, really. You know, if we get away from the idea that we really generally shouldn't use a civil suit as a method of punishment. If the person commits a wrong, there's a criminal remedy, and we ought to sue him for that. And if we want to really get him in a civil suit, we ought to sue him for punitive damages. We've got lots of remedies to punish the person. Here we're trying to distribute the burden based on who was responsible. And so, here's the intentional tortfeasor. he should contribute. Maybe he could, the only thing, he might be involved in one way or another, so maybe someone else is 10% as tall. Maybe I did throw a rock at you, but unless you pushed the guy in front of it, you wouldn't have got hit. I mean, that's kind of maybe a rough idea of what I'm saying. I throw a rock at Betty, it would have missed her, except that Senator Brown pushes her over and then she gets clobbered. So really, Senator Brown is kind of involved in the thing. So I think it's a reasonable thing. Well, anyhow, I think it's reasonable. I don't think anyone is hurt by it. And yet you have your criminal, your punishment remedy is available in other ways. Very little, I suspect. So I think now we've got Tom Bastinet here. I don't know how this is going to involve the industry. Of course, in general, intentional tort feasors are excluded from liability coverage. And I'm not sure how that's going to work. I think probably, frequently, a person will sue and include and join someone. I don't really know how it's going to work insurance-wise, but of course you can recover from someone who's at fault, normally, under the insurance policy. Normally you can't recover from the insurance company in an intentional tort situation. I think we can kind of rely on people who have a lot more wealth and experience on both the plaintiffs and the plaintiffs' side on their judgment, and the organized bar, who's all of them have had much more experience in this than I have, but I just think that there's no reason not to rely upon them, and it seems to be almost unanimous, supported by the Institute's reasoning. I don't know why we shouldn't adopt it.
Well, Chairman, I want to amend that one. To delete the of those amendments. There's three everywhere you apply, and you take one.
Where's this?
Yeah.
Well, I'm starting on page three.
Well, I believe, if I remember the argument, is this is a part of an effort to establish a uniform statute of limitations in Oregon for all causes of action. And part of the reason is to protect innocent clients from dumb attorneys, maybe too. And that is people who really aren't aware of all the niceties of the law. And one of the easiest and the most common grounds for a malpractice suit against a lawyer, is he misses the statute of limitations of one of them. And I think the one of the objectives here is so that every lawyer in the state and as many lay people as possible know that there is one statute of limitations for everything. Except probably real property. I don't know if we'll get into real property on the 3-year statute or not. Do you know? But basically, on almost everything, if not everything, there's one uniform statute of limitations.
Well, that's an argument.
Well, yes, it is.
It's not a very damn good one.
Like a friend of mine, he brought his baby to show E.B. McNaughton, and he said, "I'd like you to see my child." And E.B. said, "Yes, that is a baby."
Madam Chairman, with my vast knowledge of the subject, we continue to allow the question open for a longer period of time with everybody's concerns, and it seems to me that a year after the judgment has become final, or any appeal time has elapsed, ought to be sufficient for anyone, even a dumb attorney, to bring a case.
And they're quiet. We know that malpractice insurance.
No.
No.
I said, no, I'm a Democrat.
You can't get away. Was the light on or off? And you still your husband.
No.
Now we know where we stand. A little knowledge is good.
I'm just supposed
to. Go ahead, get me up here every morning.
Let's call it all.
I move the bill to the floor to pass as amended. Contribution bill, Laurie, with full amendment.
It's all okay.
Aye.
So,
could you come back to me just a minute, please?
So,
aye.
Robert?
Aye.
You've
got a 3-year
no.
Statute of
limitations.
Madam Chairman?
For 1 year and a
fail.
Not by very much.
Madam Chairman,
your
vote is... I'll pass if I'm Chairman.
All right. Is that the amendment?
No, that was the bill.
Okay. That finishes our agenda.
Got here again. I didn't get up to the clock.